a suggestion was made that since this is a Lutheran conference, it would not be inappropriate to have one session on Luther. I did write a biography of Luther. It came out 19 years ago. In the meantime, a good deal has been written about it. What I propose to do is to give you an account of his early development. How far I'll get along with it, I'm not sure. And to intersperse it with an account of some other interpretations which have been brought to the fore during the course of this nearly 20 years. A Catholic historian has dealt with Luther very sympathetically. Lortz, it was some 25 years ago, when he came out with the statement that to disagree with a man, you do not have to prove that he was frivolous. All you have to do is to prove you disagree with him. And in the case of Luther, he said, he was profound and desperately in earnest. Only, he said, he exaggerated. Well, that's something you could discuss. And it was different from the earlier approach to Luther. A short time ago, this same Lord said that in the intervening 25 years, he had become convinced that Luther was even more Catholic than he had supposed at the beginning. This, then, is a very respectful approach to Luther on the part of a Catholic. Some Catholics have become very enthusiastic over Luther. A year ago, I was at a conference between Catholics and Protestants in New York. The Protestants spoke at the Catholic University of Fordham, and the Catholics spoke at Union Seminary in New York. We moved from one place to the other. There was a Dominican in ordinary clothes and a red sweater who was simply dithyrambic with regard to Luther. So there is quite a change in the Catholic approach to Luther. The whole struggle of Luther stems out of the Catholic piety of the late Middle Ages. He broke with the Catholicism of his day as Paul broke with the Pharisaism of his day, because as Paul had been a Pharisee of the Pharisees, Luther had been a Catholic of the Catholics. He took seriously all that he had been taught and pushed everything to the ultimate, and came to the conclusion that the way of salvation offered by the church was not satisfying. Luther himself said that he became a monk because of the fear of death. Now, the fear of death was very prevalent in that age, partly because death was so frequent. Well, of course, everybody dies anyway. I suppose it's not more frequent in one age than another, but I mean in an early age. The average length of life was only 25. Infant mortality was very high, and epidemics swept off thousands of every age. The Black Death in 1348 had taken from a third to a half of the population of Europe. In the 16th century, there was a plague in Strasbourg. It took one-tenth, 2,500 out of 25. And in Basel, in the 1560s, there were 7,000 who were taken by the plague. The most popular form of literature was on preparation for death, Ars Moriendi. Of course, people became rather inured to the talk about death, and Huizing, in his book on the waning of the Middle Ages, says that the people became so blasé with regard to death that the church tried to stimulate their fears and would leave corpses unburied to remind people of what was in store, whereupon they'd have a picnic right in front of this ghastly display. But although some people became blasé with regard to it, others continued to take it with desperate earnestness. And of these was Martin Luther. Now, it wasn't the mere fact of dying, however, which disturbed him. It was what came afterwards. It was the judgment. And woodcuts were very popular of the Regenbogen Christ, the rainbow Christ. Christ sitting upon the rainbow, a lily protruding from one ear and a sword from the other, signifying the mercy and the wrath of God. Down below, the dead were coming up from their tombs, and some were being taken by the angels to paradise, and others were dragged by the demons to purgatory or to hell. There's one of these woodcuts in which an angel or a saint has his arms around one of the dead who's just come out of his tomb and is taking him toward paradise. But a little devil has lassoed his foot and sticking out behind, and the devil to brace himself is pushing against his rump. And the man is in a state of existential tension. Well, Luther felt precisely that way with regard to himself. And I think it's not altogether the fear of the fires of hell that disturbed him. It is rather the sense of alienation, which is understandable enough in our own generation. Alienation from the universe, alienation from the Lord of all things, alienation from God, its death and its life, and it's not feeling at home in the universe. This is the basic note in his distress. Now, the church had various ways of dealing with these fears. If there was Christ the judge, there was Mary, the Mother of Mercy, and there were continual appeals to her to intercede with her son on behalf of sinful humanity. And then there were all the saints. Luther picked 14 of them, two for every day of the week, to intercede on his behalf. Then one could do a good deal for oneself, keep the Ten Commandments, of course, but in addition, the seven works of mercy, and above all else, become a monk. And this gave one the surest pathway to heaven, so efficacious indeed that even to be buried in the cowl of a monk would be a help as a passport to the heavenly kingdom. Erasmus pulled great fun of this. He has a colloquy in which he describes a man who is being buried in the cowl of a Franciscan. And he says, will it protect the head and the hands and the feet which are exposed? Oh, yes, it goes a little beyond. And will it have any effect on the lice in the cowl? No, they won't be affected. Oh, blessed creatures to inhabit so holy a garment. Well, Erasmus poked fun at it. But Luther took it with desperate seriousness. He was a student of the law. His father, who had prospered as a miner, was sending him to the university and hoped that he would secure a post, perhaps serving some prince, and be able to take care of his parents in their old age. That was the best form of insurance in that period. Luther had no intention of doing anything other than to follow out his father's plan. But returning from a visit to his parents, going back to the university, he was caught in a thunderstorm, knocked from his horse, and cried in terror, "Saint Anne, help me, I will become a monk." He had taken a vow, he felt obligated to carry it out. He did not consult his parents on this occasion, because he knew very well that they wouldn't be happy over this, and they weren't. Within 2 weeks, he had entered an Augustinian monastery, and his father was very unhappy over it. He had hoped that the son would be the support of the parents in their old age and would continue their name. The father was resentful until another son died in a plague, and he regarded this as a divine punishment for his resentment. So then he tried to smolder his unhappiness. Now Luther gives us an account of his development in the monastery, and I'll run through that briefly and then come to some of the comments and interpretations upon it which have emerged in recent years. Luther says that during the first year in the monastery, the devil is relatively quiet. but his disturbances occurred again. And one may judge, I think, from very frequent references in his later writings, that the occasion which precipitated his disturbance for a second time was the saying of his first Mass. Now, a monk was not necessarily a priest, but Luther was chosen to be a priest as well as a monk, and therefore came to the occasion of his first Mass. It was always an ordeal. The priest believed that when he pronounced the words, "This is my body," a change took place in the elements, and the very body of God was upon the altar. Well might he tremble so to be handling divine things. But the manuals provided for all of the doubts. If the priest remembered some sin unconfessed while he was at the altar, he was to go through with the Mass and confess it afterwards. If he were so overcome with emotion, a priest at his side would take over. Luther had read all of this. He did not approach the occasion with any particular trepidation. In fact, he regarded it as a joyful occasion and invited his father and set the date so that his father could come. And the father tried to do the handsome thing, came riding in with 20 horsemen and a handsome present for the monastery. All went well until Luther came to the words in the Mass, "Vero, vivo, aeterno Deo," to the true, the living, the eternal God. And then he thought to himself, "To whom am I speaking? To the true, the living, the eternal God. He sits above the corners of the earth. Before him angels, archangels, cherubim and seraphim fall down. And who am I? Dust and ashes and sinful, to come before him, a mere pygmy, to come before him and say, I want this, I want that. If in the presence of an earthly king men should tremble, how much more in the presence of the King of Kings?" And only with the utmost struggle could he bring himself to finish the Mass and then live with the sense of the majesty, the awe, the terror, and the holiness of God. He came out to the banquet to celebrate the event, and sat next to his father. And having thus trembled before the heavenly Father, he sought some comfort from the earthly Father. And turning to him, he said, "Father, are you still unhappy over my coming to the monastery? The life is so quiet and peaceful." And his father, who had been trying to keep down his feelings, flared up and said, "You wise fool! Don't you know that the scripture commands you to honor your father and your mother? And you have left your mother and me to take care of ourselves in our old age." "Oh, but father, I could do more for you in the monastery by my prayers than I could if I'd stayed in the world. And besides, I was called by a voice from heaven."
"God grant it wasn't from the devil."
Now that was the dilemma of medieval religion. They believed in the supernatural world, but it had in it God and Christ and the Virgin and the saints and also all the demons. And the devil could disguise himself as an angel of light. The story is told that the devil once appeared before Saint Martin in radiance. Martin eyed him with scrutiny and said, "Where are the nail prints?" And the apparition vanished. Where are the nail prints? Was this experience of the thunderstorm from God, or was it from the fiend? To take him away from the word of scripture that he should take care of his parents. His disturbances recurred. But after all, he was a monk, and a monk was the surest way to heaven, and he would exploit monasticism to the uttermost. He found there were easygoing monks, and there were strenuous monks. He would outdo even the strenuous. He began with works of asceticism, going out without bedclothes till he nearly froze, going without food till his cheekbones protruded. They do in the first drawings that we have of him by Cranach. But always saying to himself, are you cold enough? Are you hungry enough? Are you poor enough? Have you done enough? It never seemed to him that he could satisfy God by anything that he did. And he also began to find that achievement is recessive. Every victory opens a new opportunity, and if you don't go on to achieve that, then you have fallen behind. God never gives you time to breathe in the struggle for perfection. But the whole Catholic system is designed for sinners rather than for saints, and it is the entire confessional system which is devised in order to relieve men of the terrors of sin and of alienation. He therefore sought to avail himself of the sacraments, in particular the sacrament of penance. This consists of contrition. That's genuine sorrow. But he couldn't be sure that his sorrow was genuine. Was he merely worried about himself, or was he really sorry for the wrong done? Next, at the end, it required satisfaction, and he was already convinced that nobody could make adequate satisfaction. But that left confession. And this he began to use to the uttermost. He would confess for 6 hours on end, and then go out and think of something he'd forgotten, because the memory is so protective of the ego. Then he'd come back and start again, till his confessor grew weary of it. And he said, now look here, fellow, if you're going to confess this much, why don't you go out and do something worth confessing? Kill your father and your mother instead of coming in here with all of these little dolly sins. Well, with Luther, it wasn't a question whether he'd done a big one or a little one, but whether he had remembered it all. For the view was that one had to specify each sin and get it confessed, one by one. But Luther began to feel that man spiritually had the smallpox, and it couldn't be cured by picking off scabs one by one. The disease affects the whole nature of man. He was disturbed not only to discover that he would forget so many sins, but that there were sins also that he didn't even recognize. Adam, after he had disobeyed God, did not suffer any compunction of conscience. He went blithely for a walk in the garden, and he wasn't troubled till he heard the voice, Adam, where art thou? David, after he had committed murder and adultery, was not troubled until the prophet said, thou art the man. So we don't even recognize our sins until we are confronted by an accuser. When Luther came to translate the psalm about secret sins, he translated it unbekannten Sünden, unrecognized sins. The sacramental system of penance was not clearing up the problem, and then the problem took on a new aspect. So far he had been assuming that God is good and man is bad, but now the doubt came, is God good? If God condemns some men before even they're born to eternal woe and chooses others for eternal bliss, can he be regarded as a good God? He took this problem to his confessor, who said to him, the trouble with you is that you're angry with God, not that God is angry with you. All you've got to do is to love God. Love him, I hate him. Odium Dei, the hate of God. That was blasphemy. His confessor said, ich verstehe es nicht. I don't understand. His confessor, an experienced confessor, doesn't understand him. Can it be that he's the only man in the whole history of the world who has been plagued like this, if his confessor doesn't understand him even? Well, the confessor understood him well enough that he needed to be drawn out of himself. He was spending too many hours in introspection. The confessor came to him and told him that he was going to study for his doctor's degree and be a professor and a preacher. "Oh, no," said Luther, "so much work would kill me." "Well, that's all right. God's got plenty of use for clever men in heaven." It was a very precarious thing that his confessor did, to take a man who was on the verge of what we call a nervous collapse and decide to make him a professor. And a preacher. But he discerned that if this man had to deal with other people's problems, perhaps he might find some drops of mercy for them, and that a few might fall upon himself. He set him to the study of the scriptures and made him the teacher of Bible in the University of Wittenberg, a lately founded university. His confessor was Staupitz. He had that chair himself. He may have resigned to give it to Luther, I don't know, but at any rate, Luther did take up this assignment. He then began a commentary on the Psalms, systematically, one by one. Precisely at what point his new insight came has been debated. The exact chronology, I think, cannot very well be determined. But from a later exposition, slightly later, of the 22nd Psalm, it appears to me that one has here a clue to his new insight. The 22nd Psalm has the verse, "My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" Luther referred this to Christ, and very naturally, because these words were quoted by Christ himself upon the cross. Forsaken. Christ forsaken. That's precisely how I feel. And I thought I was the only one in the history of the world. And Christ felt like this. How could it be? I am sinful. He was not sinful. I am weak. He was not weak. It could only be that he who was without sin, yet so identified himself with sinful humanity, that he felt himself to be on our side and with us, alienated, that he could cry out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" He took to himself the iniquities of us all. What a new picture of Christ. The judge on the rainbow is the derelict on the cross. And what a new picture of God. The God of wrath is the God of mercy, who in Christ was reconciling the world to himself. It appears almost as if there's a dichotomy in God, and that his very wrath and his mercy find their point of meeting upon the cross. And what does it mean for us? That we should give up our striving and trying to earn credit and win our way into God's favor. All we have to do is to believe, accept, trust, and yield ourselves to Him. And this it is, to be justified by faith. And I felt as if the doors of paradise had been opened. Now that's Luther's account of his own development. We have had a number of interpretations in our own day which begin on a very lower level. They interpret religious experience not in terms of its fruits, but of its roots, and very primitive roots. We have had, for example, one book which treats of the anal Luther and derives his religious development from his experiences in physical elimination. This is derived from the misreading of a text. Luther said that he had his experience in CL in the manuscript. It's an abbreviation. Denifle, the Catholic historian of around 1900, who culled out of Luther's 90 volumes all of the pitch blend of vulgarity that he could assemble, fastened on this and said that the CL stood for cloaca, the privy, and that Luther said he had his illumination under those circumstances. Well, even if he did, I don't see it matters much. I don't see that elimination necessarily precludes illumination. But as a matter of fact, it's the mistake in the reading, because the word cloaca is a feminine word. It's a masculine adjective modifying it. Therefore, that won't do. But one can fill it out in claustro, in the monastery. And that's a masculine word. In other words, he had the experience of the monastery. Well, I don't think I need to say much more about that type of interpretation. The man who wrote that book is reacting against an experience of a Lutheran mother and a Lutheran Sunday school, I understand. I'm applying a little psychoanalysis to him, you observe. Then, after the anal Luther, we get the gastronomic Luther. This we have in Osborne's play. Now, Osborne makes use of legends and gets them wrong. Cochleus, an opponent of Luther, after Luther was dead, said that when Luther was in the monastery, sitting in the choir, and the passage was read from the gospel about the casting out of the demoniac, Luther screamed, "I'm not he," and swooned. Now, not he meant he wasn't the demoniac. He wasn't possessed of a devil. In the play, Luther is at prayer with the monks. He suddenly comes in front of the stage, grabs his stomach and says, "I'm not." Well, not what? You begin to think he's denying his existence. In other words, a legend is used, and even the legend is deprived of all point. But all the way through the piece, all the way through the play, we have this recurrent gastronomic gesture. And the suggestion seems to be that Luther's religious experience has its rise in the pit of the stomach, and is very definitely connected with constipation. Well, now it's true that Luther did suffer from constipation during 1 year of his life. It was the year when he was at the Wartburg being hidden, and the diet was very unsuitable. I once made a very grievous slip. I insist it was a slip. After a lecture on Luther, I was asked whether he had any diseases. I said, "Why, yes. He suffered from acute constipation following the diet of worms." Well, chronologically, this is correct. After the diet of worms, he was secreted at the Wartburg for a year, and he didn't have that trouble. But his big ailment was not this, but bladder stone. Now, I would like to suggest to some future historian that now that we've had the anal Luther and the gastronomy and the constipation Luther, we ought to have the bladder Luther, but nobody seems to have picked this up. No, another variety of approach is the psychiatric. Now, this had its start with the Jesuit Grisard around the turn of the century. He picked out of Luther's table talk three sayings which indicated conflict with father, mother, and school teacher, and built the whole picture around these, saying that Luther was in rebellion against his parents and that he transferred this rebellion to Mother Church. The three sayings from the table talk are these. My father was once severe with me, so that I felt ugly toward him, until he was at pains to win me back. My mother once whipped me for stealing a nut till the blood came. This severity drove me into the monastery. And the other statement, that once he was whipped in school 15 times in one day. Well, now these sayings come from Luther's remarks at the table, made 30 years after the event. They were taken down by students, and frequently we find that the same saying is reported in three different ways by different students. The students wrote shorthand in Latin, but they didn't have a German shorthand. So they would take his German statements, translate them in their own heads into Latin, put them down in Latin shorthand, then go out and turn it back into German. One can see how many inaccuracies could enter in such a process. And Luther never saw his table talk. Well, it's on the basis of these three remarks that the reconstruction is made. Now, this approach of Rizar was taken up by a Danish psychiatrist named Reitzma. And from him, it is passed into Erik Erikson's young Luther. Now, whether Erikson knows where it came from, I don't know. I know that he knows the Danish psychiatrist. Whether he realizes that it came from Rizar the Jesuit and was first used for polemical purposes, I don't know. Of course, Erikson isn't interested in confessional polemics, but in psychiatric interpretation. So he plays heavily on the alienation from parents. I quoted the one that Luther said that his father was severe with him and he felt ugly against him. The word that I translate ugly is gram. Erikson took me up on that, said it doesn't mean that, it means sadly resentful. Well, now I think the way to find out what a word means is to find out how it's used by the man who's using it. And Luther, in other contexts, says, the Pope is gram against us. The devil is gram against us. Well, I don't think that means the Pope and the devil are sadly resentful with reference to us. I think ugly is a pretty good translation. But he adds, until he was at pains to win me back. Now, as a matter of fact, Luther was very devoted to his father. He was sorry that his father was, he was sad that his father was upset over his becoming a monk. He sought to get a word of approval from him at that banquet. When Luther did break with monasticism, he dedicated his tract on monastic vows to his father. Before marrying Catherine von Bora, he went down to get his parents' consent, father and mother. They were both at the wedding. And when his father died, Luther was so upset that for several days he was utterly shaken. Erikson says you wouldn't think Luther had a mother. He says so little. Well, Luther quote says one or two things about her remarks in his childhood. He went to get her consent as well as his father's. She also was at his wedding, and he wrote her a very fine letter shortly before her death. Now, I don't think it's quite right to psychoanalyze a man on the basis of a lack of acquaintance with all of the evidence. Erikson says that he is taking half legends and making them into half history. But if you're going to do that, you might as well call it half Luther. I have the feeling that he could do almost as well with anybody as with Luther. It's a young man somebody, because he takes very fragmentary information and tries to build up a complete picture. But the question as to whether Luther gets out from under human control by solving a religious problem is still a serious one. Is the great drive with him to get out from under? Erikson does not make sex the big drive in Luther, as the earlier Freudians would do. It's rather the power drive. He calls him a megalomaniac. He has to solve his identity crisis. Now that seems to mean that he's got to be somebody in the eyes of his contemporaries. And therefore it is that he has to break with father and mother and church and so on. And much is made of his, you might say, arrogant statements that he is the prophet of the Lord. Well, in a case like that, one ought to read an essay by Karl Hall, which has recently been translated into English and published in a volume dedicated to Wilhelm Pauke, on Luther's self-depreciation and self-exaltation. He did have oscillation of feeling. On the one hand, a sense of utter unworthiness, and on the other hand, that God had called him to a special mission. Now, that sense of mission, of course, can become megalomania. But it's not a simple case of a man driving to be somebody. It's the desire of a man not to be alienated from God and to be a servant of God. And it does not involve an artificial self-depreciation for the sake of looking humble. Luther said, humility does not consist in denying the truth. The Virgin Mary said, the Lord hath regarded the low estate of his handmaiden. Was she proud? Well, no, she was just telling the truth. If anybody says to me, you have lovely hands, I don't have to say, I beg your pardon, sir, they're hoofs. There's no use denying the plain truth. But you should say, whatever I have is a gift of God. It's not my achievement or my affair. Well, Luther could conceive of his own work in very exalted terms because he felt he had been given a unique place to declare his insights to his generation, and at the same time could be full of humility and doubt of himself and desperate feelings of unworthiness. Now that, of course, may suggest another thing, namely, a certain nervous and emotional instability and an oscillation between periods of exaltation and depression, in other words, manic depression. And one psychologist who read my biography said to me, well, it looks to me as if Luther was a manic depressive, but just see what he did with it. There is this degree of truth in all these approaches, that Luther's problem was the problem of his generation, but only he took it so seriously and worked it through. If there was the fear of death, if there was the terror of Christ of the judgment and so on, why weren't hundreds of people as agitated as he were? Why didn't they also have the sense of alienation? Why weren't they dissatisfied with the sacramental system? Why did it hit him so hard? And is it something in his nervous constitution which makes him more sensitive than other people are? Or is it that God has picked this man? Well, these are difficult questions to answer. I wouldn't poo-poo the attempt to bring to bear all the insights we have about human nature. But I would insist that first of all, one's got to do one's homework and get all the facts straight. And then one can start the psychological explanations. And it is also to be remembered that it's quite difficult to psychoanalyze the dead because they're not available for interviews. And the amount of information available of the kind that is significant is limited. But now I've given you a little account of how Luther describes his own development and some of the attempts to explain it in physiological or in psychological terms. I think, well, I may say one more point, namely, I think their greatest weakness is a failure to appreciate what you might call cosmic alienation or religious alienation. Luther's problem was not with his father and his mother, but with his God. It's his whole place and every other human being's place in the universe itself. It's not just how does Luther stand with reference to God, how does all humanity stand with reference to God? That's the problem that agitates him throughout his whole life, and not merely in the beginning. Well, now, it was out of this experience that he came to be a reformer without ever intending to. And probably he never would have done if he had not been not only a professor, but also a parish minister. And it was in that role that he came in contact with the indulgence affair. Indulgences began in the time of the Crusades. People who couldn't go on the crusade, but who could contribute, were given remission of spirit of penalties which had been imposed by the church. If they had been required to fast for so many days, they could let that off, or if they had to go to Compostela on a pilgrimage, that could be remitted. And then the remissions were given to those who contributed not to crusades, but to any good cause, such as hospitals or cathedral buildings. The great medieval cathedrals were built on the proceeds of indulgences. And this became a device for raising money, and a very popular device because it was voluntary. People always resent taxes, and people in the church resented tithes, which were enforced by law. If a peasant didn't pay his tithe, he might lose his cow. But if he subscribed for an indulgence, that was voluntary. So this became a very popular way of raising money. Then the benefits of indulgences were continually increased. They would remit penalties not only on earth, but also in purgatory. At first it wasn't told that they'd let you out of purgatory, but you could tell exactly how many years it would cut down on your sentence. And by, the claim was even made, you'd get an immediate release. Then they were extended to include the forgiveness of sins, and not merely the remission of penalties. The absolute peak in this kind of thing occurred in Luther's day, when Albert of Mainz of the House of Hohenzollern wanted to get the edge on the House of Habsburg by being a bishop in three places at once, and one of the Mainz, which made him the archbishop and the primate of Germany. He knew he'd have to pay the Pope a big fee. The Pope asked him for 12,000 ducats for the 12 apostles. He said he wasn't paying for the apostles. He was paying for his sins and the seven deadly sins, so he gave 7,000. And they compromised on 10. In my biography, I said facetiously, presumably not for the Ten Commandments. Then in the Luther movie, I was appalled to hear have the Pope say, well, let's make the difference for the Ten Commandments. So you see how a bit of facetiousness will turn into history. The Pope, Albert, paid the 10. He had to borrow the money from the bankers at interest. And to enable him to pay it back, the Pope allowed him to declare indulgences in his territory for 8 years, I think it was. He would get half of the money to reimburse him for what he'd already given the church. And then the other half would go to the church in order to build the Basilica of St. Peter's, the present St. Peter's. Now, Albert put out instructions in which he exceeded all previous claims for indulgences. He said that those who got indulgences on behalf of their relatives already in purgatory wouldn't have to be contrite themselves for their own sins. And that sins would be remitted as well as penalties. This would give remissionem omnium peccatorum, remission of all sins. And if you sin in the future, you would have preferential treatment. That exceeded everything that ever had been said. And then Tetzel, who was so magnificently betrayed by one of our group, in his harangue, when he was dispensing the indulgences, said they would give immediate release from purgatory. As soon as the money clinks in the chest, the souls, they jump into heavenly ranks. Now, Luther's parishioners were obtaining these indulgences, and this led to his 95 Theses. There has been a debate of late as to whether he nailed the theses or mailed them. A Catholic has been trying to show that Luther was a dutiful son of the church, because instead of posting him up for everybody to see, he sent them privately to his superior. The story of posting the theses comes from Melanchthon after Luther's death. But we do know this, that they were printed and in circulation within 2 weeks. And one can't imagine that Luther's superior would have wished to make them public. It seems to me, therefore, that Luther certainly, if he didn't nail them to the door, took them around to the printing press, which for all practical purposes amounts to the same thing. It was a public declaration. Incidentally, I think arguing over a point like this is rather trivial. I am told that at the last International Congress of Historians meeting in Germany, they spent half a day wrangling over this question as to whether they were mailed or nailed. Historians might have something better to do. The indulgences set off what became the Reformation movement. They're called the 95, but they're just that many paragraphs, that's all. There are really only 3 points. One is a complaint of the financial exploitation of the Germans by the papacy. For actually, the money went not to build St. Peter's, but to support papal wars. Luther said if the Pope knew the poverty of the German people, he'd rather that St. Peter's lay in ashes than that it should be built out of the blood and the hide of his sheep. Well, out of that, every German would say, Jawohl. There was nothing very radical here. The next point was that the Pope has no jurisdiction over purgatory, and if he does, he should empty the place free of charge. Well, a great many theologians in that period would have entirely agreed. But the third point was, the treasury of the church is the gospel. Now, that was an implicit denial of the doctrine which lay behind indulgences. And the doctrine was that the saints were better than they needed to be for their own salvation, that they died in the black, that their credits were stored up in a celestial banking house on which the Pope had the key, that he could transfer these to those whose accounts were in the red. It was a nice piece of celestial bookkeeping. And the extra credits of the saints were called the Thesaurus Meritorum Sanctorum, the treasury of the merits of the saints. And Luther, out of his own experience, had said, there are no merits. Nobody has any claim on God. We are all sinners, everyone. And we can't do any bookkeeping with God. We are dependent solely upon his grace. Now, he doesn't say it quite that bluntly in the indulgences, but he says the treasury of the church is the gospel. In other words, this gospel of God's mercy and grace, and not the accumulated merits of the saints. Now, that was the radical point in those theses. Lately, an historian has denied that there was heresy here. Albert Heimbach said the theses were an epitome of good Catholic doctrine. Well, the master of the Sacred Palace said it was heresy, and the Pope said it was heresy, and Cardinal Cajetan said it was heresy. Erasmus said, refused to call it heresy. He said, Luther is not a heretic, and he never would go back on that. Today, Father Kuhn is claiming that the excommunication against Luther ought to be rescinded. And I think in view of the ambiguities with regard to the nature of heresy, it would be entirely possible for the church to rescind that excommunication. But at the time, it was certainly considered by those in high quarters as heresy. It led to his excommunication as a heretic, and it was regarded as very serious, both from a doctrinal and a practical point of view, because it cut the ground from under the great money-raising device of the church. Well, the result was that on the Pope's behalf, a statement was made by the master of the Sacred Palace, which asserted that the church consists virtually in the Pope and representatively in the cardinals, and whatsoever the the church decrees must be accepted, and he who does not is, by that very fact, a heretic. And Luther replied, the church consists virtually in Christ and representatively in a council, but even a council may be wrong, and a pope certainly may be wrong. Well, now this lifts the whole controversy into the level of authority in religion. He denies papal infallibility. Now, of course, the pope didn't find out he was infallible until 1870. It was then that infallibility was infallibly declared. So it wasn't heresy to deny papal infallibility. There were others who did so. But it was radical, and the claim of infallibility was widely made. This raises the question about the contemporary state of affairs with regard to infallibility. It's bothering the Catholics very much now. A former student of mine has just come out with a book. He's a Catholic. Oakley, he said, he flatly denies papal infallibility. I was talking with Michael Novak about it. He said, you Protestants make altogether too much of this matter of papal infallibility. It doesn't mean a thing. I said, oh. Well, no, he said, it doesn't mean a thing, because there is no in view of the ambiguity of language, there is no infallible way in which the Pope can communicate infallibility. Whenever he says anything, the question is, what does His Holiness mean? And one puts one interpretation on it, and another, and another, and so he'll have to come out with another pronouncement to explain the preceding one, and so ad infinitum. All the Pope does when he makes an infallible pronouncement is to start a controversy as to what he meant. So that practically speaking, he doesn't mean a thing. Well, I was inclined to say, well, why does he abrogate it then? But I realized that that's difficult. A great institution with a constitution is more likely to change by constitutional reinterpretation than by repeal and amendment. It's true of the United States, it's true of the papacy. They're more likely to change by redefining things so that they don't mean what they were intended to mean than they are by flat repudiation. I would prefer to have them come out with an infallible pronouncement that the Pope is not infallible. I doubt whether it will be done in that way. Well, the point is that Luther did come out with this denial, and soon the question of indulgences rather dropped into the background. Then Luther was summoned to Rome, and at that point, his prince, the German prince, Frederick the Wise, stepped in and insisted that he should have a trial only on German soil and not in Rome. Now, some historians have said that the Reformation could not have originated anywhere except in Germany because it was politically decentralized, it had little princes, and a prince could be induced to support one who was in trouble with the church. I don't think that. After all, Spain and France and England were all having trouble with the papacy, and it would have been quite possible for a monarch in one of those countries to support somebody who was having trouble with the Pope. I don't see that it had to be German, but it is clear that Frederick the Wise stepped in. Stepped in unsolicited, Luther says. So Luther was heard by Cardinal Cajetan, who was at a diet at Augsburg, and the Cardinal confronted him with a papal pronouncement about the accumulated merits of the saints, the treasury of merits, and Luther flatly denied it. And the Cardinal told him to go and not come back unless he was ready to say revoco, I revoke, I recant. Luther fully expected to go into exile. They asked him where he'd go. He said, unter den freien Himmel, out under the open heaven, on a camping trip to the world, probably. He was just ready to leave. In 2 hours, when word came to him from the chaplain, Frederick the Wise, they shouldn't go. What had happened was a political intervention. The Emperor Maximilian was on the point of death. There would have to be a new election to the Holy Roman Empire. That was an elective institution. The possible candidates were Francis of France, Charles of Spain, Henry of England. The Pope didn't want any of them because Any one of them, if given the dignity of the empire, give control over Germany, would be too far. His choice was a little prince who wouldn't overpower the rest if he were made emperor. And the one who seemed to him most suitable was the senior member of the electoral board, Frederick the Wise, Luther's prince. So he called off the heat. And actually, Luther's process dragged on for about 4 years. Luther was allowed for these political reasons to appear at Leipzig and there to engage in a public debate. A man who had been called a heretic, a man who was expected to be burned in 3 weeks, was allowed to engage in a public debate with a man named John Eck. And Luther there asserted that the papacy was only 400 years old. And the point of that was that if it arose recently, it was not established by God or by Christ, and therefore was not a divine institution, but a human institution. Eck, of course, claimed the contrary and brought in a statement by a pope in the second century that all the churches must obey the Church of Rome. Luther said it's a forgery. Well, as a matter of fact, it's right. The next said, if you're going to put all the documents in question, I don't know where we're going to get. Well, he didn't know where they were going to get it. Luther happened to be right. It was not until June of 1520, and you remember the indulgences came out on the last day of November 1517, not till June 1520, that the Pope finally came out with the bull against Luther, giving him 60 days in which to submit. The bull began, it was written by the Pope at his hunting lodge. Arise, O Lord. And then he went on. Arise, O Peter. Arise, O Paul. Arise, all the saints. As if the Lord Jesus couldn't handle it alone. To drive this wild boar from the vineyard. And then gave Luther the 60 days. Well, now the 60 days, he started ticking when the bull was actually delivered to the man named. So great was the support for Luther, even among German bishops, that he took John Eck, who had the task of delivery, from June the 20th to October the 10th to get to Wittenberg and hand it to Luther. So that gave Luther until December the 10th. In the meantime, Luther heard that a bull was looking for him. But it hadn't arrived, so he took advantage of the interim and put out ever more radical tracts. Now, one of those was the address to the German nobility, in which he called for the reduction of the papacy to apostolic poverty, and another was on the sacraments, in which he reduced them to baptism and the Lord's Supper, and denied transubstantiation. I see our time is up, I can't go into detail. But it was really his attack on the sacraments that was the most drastic change on his part. When Erasmus saw that, he said, the breach is irreparable. He tried himself for the next 10 years to try to bridge it. I don't think for him it was irreparable, but he felt the church would never come to terms with Luther's treatment of the sacraments. Well, I observe that our time is up, so we'll have to leave it there.